Hi, it's Dan here for Dusty Discus Radio, and this is the podcast Liner Notes, revealing chats with Canada's retro music makers. Today, I'm very honored to have as my special guest, the rock warrior himself, John Michael Thor. We'll be talking music, travels, the business of music, the ups and downs of a life as a career entertainer, and we'll get some other insights as well about life in the music business over the past 50 years and what he's up to now. So thanks for joining me today, Thor. How are you?
I'm doing great, and it's an honor to be on your show.
Well, I appreciate it. It was great to have you. I tried before, and then I said, well, we have to have John Michael Thor on here because he's, you're talking Canada's retro music makers. I mean, you're right on the list there, right at the top of the list. So thanks for coming on.
Well, I'm glad I made the list, and 50 years is a long time, and yeah. You're right. There's a lot of ups and downs, but it's been a great career, and proud to be Canadian.
And, yeah, well, I didn't realize you were born in Vancouver. I thought you were from Toronto because that's where you kind of came out of, but I didn't realize you were born in Vancouver.
Yes, I was born in Vancouver and started my musical career in Vancouver. Okay. And that's where the Thor concept started. Our first concert was at the New Westminster High School.
Nice.
February the 8th of 1974, believe it or not. And the opening act was Applejack, who later became Trooper.
There you go. Well, very cool. Well, it's funny because I often talk to my guests about the timelines. And when you're looking back and you think, man, 50 years, that's half a century. It's bizarre looking back, isn't it?
That's older than you are.
No, not quite. I'm catching up to you.
Okay. You sound young, anyhow.
Well, no, I'm only a few years behind you, but rock and roll keeps us young. And so it's interesting.
That's true.
Yes. And I saw that that you always wanted to be a superhero, but then your parents got you to play the accordion too. So I know lots of accordion jokes. And I know you kind of mentioned that that wasn't a super cool instrument, but it was probably a good instrument to train on.
Well, later, Weird Al Yankovic made it a super cool instrument.
There you go.
But it was a good one to write songs with, really.
Well, so what I was trying to figure out with you is that you were kind of on a dual track, right? You liked the bodybuilding and that sort of stuff. And obviously, you spent lots of time doing that because you looked great and you won some competitions and stuff. But then music, too. So you were kind of on a dual track, I'm thinking.
Growing up, I was really into, this is going back to the 50s. I was really into superheroes and watching The Adventures of Superman starring George Reeves on television.
Yes, absolutely.
And then I also like the cowboy shows, with Gene Autry and Roy Rogers, where they, the won the day and they ride into the sunset with their trusty horse. So I thought that was really cool. And then there was Steve Reeves, who was Hercules, and my brother was a bodybuilder and a star athlete. So I was inspired by all this, and I started training at a very young age. But I found out that when I listened to music, it made me train harder.
Right.
So it was – and it's something later on, if you see the – all the exercise shows, they have music and people train with music. But I found out the pulsing rhythms would get me going.
For sure, yeah. Well, lots of athletes, the hockey players, they get the fighters and stuff, they always come out to their songs, right? They probably use some of your songs in there.
Yeah, well, our songs have been used WWE and other sports.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's cool. So, but you had to spend a lot of time in the body. You became a bodybuilding champion, right? Mr. Canada, and you won the U.S. one as well. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah. At 7 years of age, I started training, with my brother. He showed me how to train with weights. Yeah. And I just kept getting bigger. And I was 12 years old and I started getting interested in competing in bodybuilding championships. And so in my early teens, I did compete. At 16, I went into the Mr. Western Canada contest and placed very high and won the most muscular division. And they had various divisions back then, like best legs or best chest and most defined, et cetera. And that got me inspired to keep going. And the following year, I won 7 trophies, Mr. Junior Canada and, Mr. Pacific Coast. And then I just kept going from there and then yes, I had a Mr. USA title under my belt, and also Mr. Canada by 1973.
And so what were you doing musically at that time? Would you train in the daytime, and then were you still playing and writing songs and trying to get your music career on the go, or was it
put on the back? I started in various bands in 1960s, you know, in high school. One band was called The Ticks, sort of like a wood tick, very Beatlesque. You know, we did a lot of Beatle-type songs. We would write the songs.
Of course, yeah.
And they were pretty melodic, actually, you know, pretty good songs. And then there were the Cougar Boys. That's another band we had. And then I wanted to get heavier. So there was a band called Man, and that was in the later 60s. And so it just kept leading up to, you know, what, trying to be more theatrical as that style came in the early 70s with the glitter rock, as bands like Alice Cooper came in, Kiss, the more wilder you were, the better.
Well, yeah, it's funny because a manager of mine years ago said that, you know, show rhymes with dough, right? If you want to make money, you got to put on some kind of a show. And then you, of course, took that to the to the extremes, really. I mean, you were right up there in terms of your stage presence and stage show. So you really embraced that.
Yes, I did. That was my inspiration of the Hercules movies, the Superman movies, etc. I very in awe of Alice Cooper when he came out, you know, with the snakes, and he hung himself and did all those crazy things. And David Bowie when he was Ziggy Stardust. Yeah. So I thought I could be this superhero character on stage. And so we started getting out there, getting really wild costumes. And this is all in Vancouver, where this started in 1973, where there was a costume maker did costumes for the Cave shows at the Cave. Right. If you remember that old place.
Yeah, I do.
Izzy's Supper Club. And so I got these glitter outfits and put together a band. And then I had these other fellow muscle men behind me posing to choreography and just try to make it a wild show. So, and then we played, you know, the Commodore Ballroom one time, you know, Geldof was in the audience. He was an exchange student at that time from the Boomtown Rats. Bob Geldof, and he gave us a rave review, an absolute rave review in Georgia Strait, and so that really kind of got us some attention.
Yeah, and that was what was the name of that band, of the album and the band?
Well, our band was called Michael Body Rock.
Body Rock, right? That's of course.
Yeah, but it was really us, you know, dressing up in the Thor style or gladiator style attire, and people dubbed us a muscle rock.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that's what I always heard. Muscle rock. But it was a glam.
Glam. Yeah, it was very glam. Glitter with Grecian sandals and
totally
muscles.
Cool.
And
so, but you landed in Toronto. So I always thought you came out of Toronto because, you know, I know Frank Soda, of course, and I know the story of how you connected with him, but that all came out of Toronto. How did you end up in Toronto?
Well, I went over to tour Hawaii. You know, after my stint was over in Hawaii, I came back to Vancouver again. And my agent said, hey, I got a whole tour for you up in northern British Columbia. I said, oh, great. You know.
I've been there, done that many times.
So he sent me up to Kitimat.
There you go.
We went to play Kitimat. And I got off, you know, they had a shuttle from the airport and everything. And I got off the bus and there was this fellow meeting me. And he goes, hi, I'm Frank Soda, you know. And we became friends ever since. We're still friends all these years.
Oh, he's a great guy.
Great wonderful, talented man.
Yeah. And well, you probably didn't realize at the time what a great guitar player was picking you up, because Frank was the real deal, right? Or still is.
He's as great as they are. He's still like he's on our new album.
Yeah.
And you know, we have very a nice single coming out. Our next single Frank's on it, and he plays fantastically. But long story short was we played that night together, and he was amazing. And so after the show, I said to him, you know, I'm going to continue this tour, and I have some plans for my show, and you know, I'm going to contact you again. And we're going to do some stuff together.
Cool.
Because I was that impressed with him.
Yeah.
So I ended up next. I got offers to play the whole Ontario circuit, and okay. If you thought Kitimat was cold, try to go to Kapuskasing. So I went to Kapuskasing and Timmins and all these places, you know, the whole circuit in Ontario.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And yep. I just pounded the pavement. But we developed quite a following. And this is going into 1975 now. And so I just kept touring and touring. And then for Christmas, I went back to Vancouver, you know, to see family and take a break. And then the agent said, hey, you know, you got all kinds of these offers coming in, and you know, you got to get you back out here. So yeah. You know, can you get out here? And I said, you know what, I'm gonna come out, but I'm gonna do it a little differently this time. We're gonna get a bit heavier. I'm not just gonna play these cover songs. Well, I want to be right. More original, you know, because at that time in Ontario, they'd want you to play "That's the Way," I like right. it, you know, stuff like that, right, Casey?
Yeah,
the Sunshine.
Yeah, there you
know,
go,
boys. You know, there, but you know, stuff. You had to kind of like. Squeeze in your original songs when you can, but most of the promoters and the club owners want you to play the cover tunes. So,
yeah, right.
But I wanted to go, I told the agent, I said, I want to go all, you know, original now. And he says, oh, okay, well, that's a tough thing, but well, let's give it a try. And I said, you know, there's one guy I'm going to call, and that's Frank Soda. So I called Frank Soda. He was up in Kitimat. And I said, Frank, I want you to come with me, and we're going to go out east and conquer the world. Yeah. And he says, yeah, are you sure?
So, the world? I'm Thor, you know, man. We're doing it.
yeah. So he took my word, and he came down to Vancouver. We rehearsed for 2 weeks, then went on the train together and went out to Toronto. And we just did everything that we could. We did the whole circuit. We went back up to Kapuskasing, Timmins, St. Catharines, the whole works. We just kept playing the Ontario circuit until they cried uncle. But we, we sure developed a following. And, our main goal was to get a record deal. And we kept trying. We kept calling everybody and getting, you know, doing demos, getting turned down and, you know, and reaching out even to Kiss's management, Bill O'Coyne, who we did a showcase for and got to play and made an appearance at Maple Leaf Gardens with Kiss in 1976. So, but we called ourselves Thor and the Imps, and I would lift Frank Soda up over my head while he played lead guitar and throw him into the audience. And I would say we had a really spectacular show at that time. Oh, it was, you know, amazing.
So you call them the Imps because, well, Frank, anybody who knows Frank, he's probably 5 foot something, right? And very slight and small person. And you're Thor. So it would be pretty easy for you to pick him up.
I was this behemoth. And Frank was, a short fellow, and lithe and then there was Charles Towers, much the same, and John Lesisher. So anyhow, we do this show and people really got into it. And we did the whole makeup thing too. Like, very much, cause it was a Kiss were just becoming huge. And the whole glitter rock thing was really big in 1976. And so, we were well received, not by the critics so much, but the fans.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And of course you're paying your dues too, right? Like people have to realize that, like you're on the road, you're banging it out. You're probably were you doing six nighters back then? Like a lot of guys did.
Yes. We were doing six nighters. Back then you would come into a town and play a club for six nights. And then Sunday was your travel day. And sometimes it would get split up three nights in, say, St. Catharines and three nights over in Niagara Falls. And you had to bring your PA and your lights.
Oh, yeah.
So you had to have trucks.
Been there, done that. I did that lots,
And I would be a roadie myself. I'd have to be lifting in there, then do the show at night. You get a good pump anyway.
Well, you know what? I always think that keeps you humble, but it also makes you part of the process. Like I've spent lots of time in the truck or with my face in the back of an amp rack, whatever, man, that just makes you better. I don't need to be a rock star.
Yes. We did whatever we could do, you know,
yep.
If there wasn't enough room in the van, we take turns lying in the back, you know, with the equipment.
there you go. Yeah. Yep.
Whatever it took to try to make it. And that was our goal. You know, we always had in our mind, we wanted to have a record deal, like a real legit record deal. And
you got one eventually, right? How did that
happen? I mean, we did put out our own sort of limited EP called Thor and the Imps Muscle Rock, which had songs like I Gotta Eat, dun, dun, da, 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 because you had to eat back then.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, it was tough. Yeah. You know, and other tunes. And Frank and I would write these songs, and I thought they were really good. They were the catalyst of what was to come for both of us. I eventually signed with RCA Records, and Frank Soto went on Quality Records. We decided, this is after I went to Las Vegas. They just didn't come to Las Vegas with me when I got the offer in 1976. It was a big opportunity. They had talent scouts come out to Toronto to see us. And then I said, Frank, we got to go to Las Vegas. And they somehow, you know, didn't want to go. So they just continued on as Frank Soda and the Imps. And I went to Las Vegas. And that's kind of where our directions changed and where we each got our own record deals.
Right. Yeah. I was wondering about that because you stayed friends with Frank. I mean, Frank's just a first class guy.
Oh, right? We're always friends. I mean, you know, if you work with people, even in Walmart, you know, and you have some different ideas and or whatever, you know, you still are friends, you know, it's just the way things are. And being creative and having records are no different. And we were very amicable. Of course, there are bands like the Eagles who want to kill each other.
That's what I mean.
We were never that way.
No, good. Well, that's good.
Frank and I still get together and have our annual turkey dinner at the White Spot every Christmas.
Nice.
You know, you know. And again, Frank was at my house the other day, and we were practicing because he's going to be playing some of the tour coming up.
Yeah, no, that's great. I was going to ask you about that too. I want to ask you about that. But what I wanted to ask you about was, so it's Keep the Dogs Away was really, that's when I heard of you guys and I saw the album, I owned that album. And that was really what catapulted you into sort of national status. Was that, you think that's correct?
Yeah, I would say international status actually.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, Chum would play us and, you know, then it got over to England, Japan, and into the United States, and it just kept going on from there.
So where was that recorded? And did you have a producer, like a record company producer?
I worked with Three Hats Productions. They were producers, and we did a lot of the work at Phase One in Toronto. Okay.
Yeah, I was curious about that because, you probably don't remember, but I met you in 1980. You were playing at the Center Point in Coquitlam because they had the Boo Pub and the Center Point Pub and the Center Point Cabaret, and you were playing there, and I think it was around 1980, and so we came down to see you, and then we hung out with you actually on the break because you were outside cooling off and you'd just mutilated a couple of mic stands and bent some iron and blown up some stuff. So you were cooling off outside. So we got to hang out. I was a guitar player and my other guy was there. And then you told me that you did the photo shoot for that in New York. And you told us the story about the dogs and how difficult that was. So that's when I met you the first time. So tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to say when you came down at that time, there were so many more places to play for live bands at that time, all over Vancouver, all over British Columbia, and the same goes for Ontario. It's not the same anymore in that way. With the dogs, I know when we were taking the photographs, the trainer would wear a mask to try to get the dogs to attack him. But then the dogs started attacking me instead.
Yeah.
And they'd go around in circles with the leash, and I fell over. And
well, you had four of them too, right?
Yeah, so I was having a little bit of difficulty, but then we got everything in order. Was lucky I didn't get bitten. It worked out okay, and we got a few good shots.
Well, the picture's epic. I mean, that's just that's the ultimate album cover. I mean, I saw that and I thought, okay, I'm buying this right now. Just based on that. But So that was done in New York. So did you have the record company must have had a US connection, right? It was a international deal or North American deal?
We shot that in Toronto, in an alleyway in Toronto.
Okay. But, I thought it was
I kept control of my, production. Of the master tape, right? That was part of my deal. I kept control of the master tape. We did a P&D. It was like a P&D deal, like RCA picked it up and then also we had Midsong down in the U.S. and different. There was all different labels in throughout the world, and I tried to be a businessman right from the beginning.
I saw that records on here. So. Yeah. So you had a distribution deal, but you kept your own, you looked after your own end too and kept your master tapes and the rights, I'm assuming, songwriting.
That's right. Exactly. Videos. And so it got re-released just recently again as a Purple Haze edition.
Yes, I did see that. That's very cool.
Frank Soda and I plan to do a special production where we hand out some Purple Haze albums and we do Keep the Dogs Away and go into Purple Haze, because Frank does an incredible rendition of that.
No, very cool. So that's what I wanted to ask you about. I mean, so you're there, you got a record deal, you got the big album cover, you got tunes being played. You're a rock star at that point, right? And then things kind of went sideways on you?
There were a few things that were, you heard about Bruce Springsteen, right? He had battles, between the manager and
Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, Leonard Cohen. I just saw the documentary for Leonard Cohen Columbia wouldn't release his album in America, yet it had Hallelujah on it, one of the greatest songs in history. And it was just unbelievable. For whatever reason, there's a lot of egos in this business. There's no explanation sometimes for what happens, why people or why record executives do what they do. It could be their own beliefs or whatever.
I guess a few issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, you're just in a sense, it sounds disparaging, but you're a meat puppet to them. I mean, the suits wreck the business as the saying goes, right? And so you're just a commodity. You're not a who, you're a what, in the sense that you're my boy. I'm going to do this and that until I don't want to, then I'll toss you out like yesterday's news. That's just the nature of it, right?
But that's what we are, I guess, when in this business. Like right now, if I wasn't selling records, do you think Cleopatra Records would put out another record?
Right. Fair enough.
Been like 4 years with the pandemic. They still put some records out during in 2022. We did a record during the pandemic. We couldn't tour for it, but we put it out. But they would just say, hey, we can't, it's cost a lot of money to make records, it costs a lot of money to record. And I mean, because of digital, less than it was when it was analog, but that's how it is. I don't get hurt by it. I know that I'm a product, right? I'm a product and I get insulted, even on the new single, there's all these comments, right? Well, one says, wow, this is great. Wow, the best ever. And you sound like Leonard Cohen. I like that one. And then another one says DOA, you got to just take it for what it's worth. I can't say, hey, I'm going to find that guy. I'm going to tell him a thing or two, search him down for his comments. It's just the way it is. You got to have a hard shell.
Yeah, I guess everyone's 100% correct in their own opinion, but I guess the music business, you don't need to exploit people. Like that's the one thing that I never liked. And the people that tried to treat me like a commodity, I would say to them, well, I'm a human being. Like I got kids to feed. I got a life I'm trying to live here. Yeah. I'm not just a commodity. That you can still do the business and respect the humanity in the person. And I think some of the record people didn't quite get that memo.
Well, that's well said. I think that's understood. And sometimes I think, for example, I think Spotify, for example, should pay more to the artists and not just give them pennies, or what it is now where the big artists are going to be allowed to take those artists who aren't making enough. They're going to have to take their money too. You know, well, what are you doing it for then? Are we just this because it's a lot of fun? Well, it is fun. Yeah, but you know, if you're not making some money, then is it a business?
And especially for someone like you, I mean, you had a platform, right? Like you're not an up and coming sort of artist. I mean, you've been there. So you should be considered in that category, not some guy who's scratching for attention. Everybody knows who you are. You were right there. You were very successful at one point.
Yeah, I still like to think I am. But in the 70s, you know, the record companies were fat cats and so were the artists. I mean, really everybody was making big coin in the 70s, you know.
Lots of money being splashed around.
You know, then as time went on and with Napster coming in, free downloads, and it just changed the industry substantially. And that's kind of where we're at right now. There's just,
I don't know if you know the answer. I've asked a few people, but Spotify, like they pay like 0.003 cents or some ridiculous number per stream. But who sets that? Is that an arbitrary number? Like they just pick a number?
That's something that everybody's upset with. Yeah. Like that's a good question. Who sets that? Why is it that way? Why can't it be changed? Why can't it be 10 cents?
Or something. I mean,
every stream should be 10 cents.
Well, then somebody made the point that the guy that owns Spotify is worth hundreds of millions of dollars, never written a song in his life and never, you know, done anything except put this platform together and then pays the artist. You're getting table scraps, basically crumbs that are falling from the table, and he's making a pile of money.
That's where it gets tough. You know, so many bands now. Why do you think so many of the older bands are going out there and tour, like 80 years old, 81 years old, and they're out there touring? You know, because they have a lifestyle to keep and the money's not coming in with the sales of the records with Spotify and other platforms. So there has to be a way. There has to be a way where, where's it going to go? And with AI coming in, I think it's just going to get worse.
Well, that's probably right. I remember Peter Frampton testified before our congressional committee in the United States. And he was making the point, I can't remember the exact numbers, but he said he got something like 3 million streams and he got a check for $1,700 or some ridiculous amount.
Yes.
Or, you know, and he said that's just disproportional. Like, he was a major star with major hit songs that should be way more than that. And so he was making that point, but I'm not sure what they did about it.
They don't know quite yet what to do about it. Right. And they're, there's a quandary what to do with AI.
Yeah, there you go. Because computers can write songs and lyrics now, and you can claim it as your own. And so how's that going to work?
Yes, it's getting better and better, you know. I've heard some guys write songs and make it sound like the Beatles recorded it, and it sound incredible, sound just like the Beatles.
Yeah, and you can take the mix parameters from a Steely Dan album, write some lyrics. You don't even have to sing or even play now. You don't have to do anything.
That's what's happening. And that's, you know, there's going to be a lot of changes coming up and the unknown is out there. What's going to happen? You know, what's going to happen with music?
Well,
will it just be sort of like turning on the lights, you know?
Maybe.
I'm turning the lights on right now. The lights are coming on, you know, it's just going to be some common thing.
I mean, my point about that is the consumer doesn't really care. Like if you get a haircut by a person or you get a haircut by a machine, it's the result that people care about. If people listen to a song and they like it and you say, well, that was AI generated, that guy doesn't even be a musician, they're not going to care, really. They're just going, I like the song.
That's what I'm saying.
We'll ride it out old school. We're both old school, so that's the way I'm doing it, you know.
I come from from an old school. I was right there in the 70s where the hard copy records and
That was the golden age, right? I mean, the 60s, 70s, and 80s really was the golden age of music. And we're well past that now, more than 30 years past that, I think. And so I often ask my guests, you know, how has the music business changed over the last 50 years? And they usually just laugh because it's a completely different world. What's your take on that?
I think that it is a completely different world. And I think maybe when we reach Mars and we have civilization on Mars, and cities on Mars, and there might be a new way of doing music up there. You never know where people when you become a Martian, and you'll be able to make some royalties.
But I guess my overriding point, is that, you know, how much of what you did or what people at that time did was a function of that time, right? And I mean, there has to be a factor and a major factor, I would think.
Yes. Yeah.
With the albums and the hype, just the excitement about music too. Playing in a band was the coolest thing in the world. And you waited for the radio and you waited to see the band and buy the album. And that's kind of waned, I think, a little bit now.
Yeah, I think that like when I was in high school, if you were in a band, oh man, people, that was the coolest thing, you know. And and now, you know, being a DJ is a cool thing, or being an influencer is a cool thing on YouTube.
Yeah, right.
You know, not just it's different. It's all it's a different world right now. Yeah. What was cool then is not as cool now, and there's other things that the young fans think are cool.
Yeah, too many distractions too, right?
Yeah, I mean their attention span is like very it goes quick. Like if some record comes out, they like that record. Well, next week another record. Next week another record. You know, so just there keeps churning them out. Like this.
Well, I was doing a seminar one time on helping people with their stage shows and stuff, and you're of course expert at that and had a wonderful stage show, but I said, well, imagine the audience that everybody's got a clicker in their hand and they're turning the volume up and down or changing the channel. Like everyone's got their sort of internal clicker now, right? Okay, this the bridge in this song, I don't like, click, what else is on, click, 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 and then they're back to you. Okay, that's back to the verse, I like that. Like you're right, the attention span is like minuscule now compared to what it used to be.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I watched a movie, I Am Thor, which is very cool. I'd seen it before, but I watched it again in preparing for this interview because I wanted to ask you a few questions about it. So if you don't mind, can I just rip down a list of questions that I had from watching the movie?
Sure, and I'll cherry pick my answers.
Okay, your discretion. So you were on the Merv Griffin Show. I mean, you were at the point where you've made it. Like the Merv Griffin Show, that was the bomb back then in any of those shows. But that's very cool. 1976, you're on the Merv Griffin Show. You must have felt pretty darn good, like you'd got to where you wanted to be.
Well, in my mind, you know, I always had this thing about the Beatles, you know, what they did. And I was so influenced in my whole career by them. And in the beginning of my career. So when I saw that they were on Ed Sullivan, I wanted some kind of a national highlight in my life and a break. And so in 1976, live from Caesar's Palace, when I was on the Merv Griffin Show, that was my big break. It was seen by millions and millions of 100%. People. And then I got opportunities from it. In fact, you know, the new album "Keep the Dogs Away" came about because people saw the Merv Griffin Show, and I got movie offers, you know, and more.
Yeah. So, but then you make the point in the movie that, you know, you were the real deal. I mean, you were right up there with Kiss and all those other glam rock bands, and you had the show and the hype and the record deal, but you never got to the level of success that you wanted to, and then. You know, you said you got kidnapped and there was a whole bunch of management and business crap got in the way. What's your take on that, looking back?
Things got messy at times, you know. Like I was saying before, Springsteen and Mike Appel had a battle, and Mike Appel battled Columbia Records. And you could go back into all kinds of things that happened, or, you know, with different bands. And for example, the Turtles, you know, I was a young guy, all these things were happening, and things got to be all over the place. I think I had one direction, but, you know, when you let other people kind of control you, like management and record companies, and they have conflicts themselves against each other, you're caught in the middle. And then what do you do? You just want to go out there on tour.
Yeah,
and promote the record, because I was full of energy. I was full of beans to get out there and show my wares, show that we could be a great band, and I could sing and I could do all these things. And then the record company and the management company are battling, you know, and it screws you up.
But more than that, though, you said you got kidnapped and held, and that there was some heavy, you hint at maybe some you know, underworld involvement or some kind of more nefarious involvement there. It was the hint that you gave.
Yeah, I don't go into that now.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. But anyway, you got caught between a rock and a hard place, basically, between management and record company.
That's correct. Yeah. But I never gave up, you know, when all that was going on and the people were suing each other. I said, I'm going to keep going here. I'm going to somehow, you know, get this, keep the Dogs Away tour going. And I wanted to keep in shape with my singing and just stage presence. So what I did is I went to Las Vegas. I signed a contract for a show called Space Circus.
Right. I did see that. And, yep.
Yeah. And then I was able to do this live show with costume changes and try out new things. And then after a while of performing in Las Vegas, I felt I was ready to go back into the battle again, which I did. I went back to Toronto, and then I put a band together, and I told RCA, you know, whether you like it or not, even though you guys are still fighting, whatever, I'm going out there and I'm going to promote Keep the Dogs Away. So yeah, I went out there and I went right across Canada. We went into the United States and we just kept touring and touring and touring. And we wouldn't stop.
Well, how did you end up in England then? Because that came about just after that time. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. So where I'm talking, like, this is about 1978, 79. Okay. And then the record went all over the world, right? Keep the Dogs Away. So it actually was hitting the charts in England. People, you know, loved the record over the years.
Yeah.
It sort of had a life of its own. You know, it's like not in the same scale as, but Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen, you know, where it just had you know, it got rejected by the label for United States, but it just kept going by other people singing it. And it just kept, you know, having a life of its own. It went off on its own to get people to know about it. And Keep the Dogs Away kind of did the same thing. I mean, it's like I said, it got re-released here in 2024.
Yeah, you know? Super cool.
And people still know that song. Young kids know this song.
Oh, yeah.
I get asked about all the time. It's on YouTube all over the place.
And,
you know, and that's another story, you know, but the internet, but so we kept touring and got into the 80s and kept touring, went into New York and doing shows in New York. And, you know, picked up new management and so on and so forth, and got rid of management, got more didn't always get along with the managers, right?
Yeah.
Because I found many times I could manage myself better than managers could manage me. So I went into New York, and then we recorded a song that sounded pretty good, Anger, and then decided, okay, we're going to record a EP. You know, trying to come back after Keep the Dogs Away. And that was all I was trying to do, get a record deal after Keep the Dogs Away. And because of the situation where people were in litigation, you know, and that kind of cleared up, it got settled while I was in New York.
Okay.
It was time to try to get a new deal. So anyhow, I came up with this new album called Unchained, which was going to be produced by Felix Pappalardi, who played in Mountain. He also produced Cream. He was going to produce the album. And this is like 1983 now. You see, time is going on. I'm getting old, right? Yeah. I only got so much time to get things going. Before, you know, I don't want to be like, in my 50s trying to get deals going, my second album going, you know?
Yeah, right.
So
the follow-up album's important, right? As you know, like you get the initial hype, but you got to strike while the iron's hot, right?
That's right. And there was a lot of recordings that were being done, but no record deal. So we got this one going. Okay. So anyhow, we're all set to go in the studio, and then Felix Pappalardi's wife shoots and kills him in a crazed night they had.
Wow.
So I ended up producing the album myself and got a deal with Mongol Horde, a new metal label at the time, because metal was really coming in strong in the 83-84 era. And then I was soliciting a manager who managed Motorhead. His name was Douglas Smith. He wasn't that interested before. But then we had a big article when we signed with the Mongol Horde. And again, that was a P&D deal where I controlled the rights to my master. So we did this deal, and Billboard did a big article on me. And so he saw this article when he was flying back and forth, you know, from New York to England. And he said, boy, maybe the guy's got something. So he said, he contacted me and he said, you got this record here. Are you interested in coming to England? Do you want to at least give it a shot, go to and play the marquee? And you know, so what we did is did a deal with him, and the band went over to England, and this is early 1984, and we played the marquee when the legendary places where David Bowie played and the Yardbirds and everybody. And it went over like gangbusters. And we got three encores. All the magazines loved us. Kerrang said he came, he thore, he conquered.
Yeah, that's great.
And, you know, so we had a new life again. All of a sudden, our life changed. It's sort of like, you know, when the Stray Cats were over in England trying to battle it out, you know, going from label to label, they were sleeping on the bench and suddenly something happens. Wow, we got a big deal, get a record deal, and the press loves them, and then they became huge, right? Things went great for us.
What was the result in England? I mean, you were doing great. I saw the on the video there. On the movie, there's some video of that. The place is packed. You're just rocking it. You're right where you think you need to be.
Yes. I think things went great. You know. I mean, we were making records. Douglas Smith was doing great by us. We're doing shows with Motorhead, Girl School. Nice. You know, we're right in the thick of things. You know, we were invited to royal events, you know.
Yeah. Cool.
You know, we were the toast of the town. Yeah. But, you know, it only lasts for so long. You know, you're having some. We had number one hit with Thunder on the Tundra, which is a big in the rock charts. Yeah. And Let the Blood Run Red did really good. And the album did really good. And then, you know, then they're on to Whitesnake, you know, or somebody else, you know. That's just Metallica, you know.
Yeah. You're taking the ride, but the ride is up and down, right? So.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you're only as good as your next hit, right? And then I signed contracts to be in movies. I did a movie called Recruits, which won a silver award in England, and then I went Rock and Roll Nightmare, Zombie Nightmare that. With Adam West and Tia Carrere, and and then I felt in 1987 I had enough, and you know,
So was acting a passion for you? Did you enjoy that?
I liked acting. Yes, it was great.
I was just wondering if you were going to pivot from being a musician to being an actor. You make the point you were in a bunch of B movies, but you wanted to get to where the Ferrigno and those guys were making the big movies, right?
Yes, I actually one movie I signed a contract was Adventures in Babysitting, and Chris Columbus was directing it. And became a pretty big movie. I was all set to, you know, I learned all my lines. I was doing wardrobe, and then suddenly they said, we have no need of your services any longer. We're paying you off. Mm. You know, get lost. Because they got Vince D'Onofrio. You know, the guy played in Full Metal Jacket. He played Pyle, right? You know, so he was up and coming, and that's how the business is. You're a product, right? You know,
That's right.
Well, we decide, hey, we want this guy now. So you're out, you know.
Yeah.
See you later. Maybe we'll use it sometime in the future.
So then you track in the movie how you went into a dark and confusing time. You're in New York, I can see there, and then you ended up back in Vancouver. And I guess you had what you called a nervous breakdown, but you just sort of had enough of the business. Yeah. You'd been going full steam for a lot of years, and how did that affect your life?
It was actually, in the end, very good for me because I was able to use my creativity and resilience to come back. And I went into the South and started a new company called Product Express, and it was very successful. It enabled me to come back and start a record company called Star USA Records.
Well, that's very cool. And so you made the best of that. But it says here you left show business in 87, basically for 10 years. You just took a 10-year hiatus from performing or doing the band things or recording?
That's right. But then all that time, you know, I would think about songs and writing songs, and I would write scripts, and you know, but more of a pastime than full time.
Right.
You know, at that time I concentrated on building my company and making it as profitable as possible.
Yeah. And then you got the itch after, I guess, a decade of going back out and playing, but then again, you're right back into the touring costs and keeping the band going and a lot of challenges, right? So you don't downplay that in the movie. It comes out loud and clear. I mean, it's tough, right? It's a tough biz. And you were doing a lot of it yourself at that point.
That's right. Yeah. And I just kept battling. And how many, there's 40 studio albums I've done.
Yeah.
You know, and wow. Well, with Star USA Records, like I started Star USA Records and I signed all these bands, but none of them were selling. So he says, man, I can't go down with Star USA Records. And so then I put out Anthology, which is sort of some of songs that I had in the can. And I never finished them. And I thought I'd put them on this record. And it did really well. And then we went on tour and we just kept going from there. And really didn't stop. And so from then on, here I am, like in my 70s. Can you believe it? In my 70s, and I'm still rocking and rolling. I don't believe it.
I love it, man. I'm a supporter. I think if you want to get up there and do your thing, man, I'm behind you 100%. I think it's great. It's an inspiration, and it's fulfilling to you. And hey, why not? You know, I mean, there's no reason not to.
Hey, so. The Rolling Stones were, you know, in their 80s, and McCartney. I mean, they're influences. I mean, those guys can do it. Gee, I should be able to do it. You know, they were taking acid and doing all kinds of drugs back when I was bodybuilding and
there you go.
Drinking Super Pro 101 and trying to be a health nut.
Yeah.
So there you go. You know, at this age, I should be able to, you know, do stuff.
Well, and some people make disparaging comments about being a nostalgic act, and I'm thinking, well, so what? You know, what have you done? I mean, if you're still doing it 50 years later and doing your thing, like, so what? Like, it shouldn't be a disparaging comment. It should be a uplifting and saying, hey, this guy's been there. He's done that for half a century and he's still doing it. Isn't that great? Everyone should smile about that. That's a great thing.
Yeah. Well, look at all the seniors out there rocking and rolling. You know, people are living longer.
Yeah.
I mean, you could be, maybe I'll be the first centurion to...
there you go.
To be on tour, rocking and rolling, and putting albums out.
Yeah, you know? Well, you'd have my support of that. So your website's got lots of information on it. Actually, it's quite good. It's thorcentral.net. But you've got all the past tours, like you were down in the States, like from 2009 or 2019, 2016. You've got all the tours on there and the places you went and stuff too. So that's cool. I really appreciate that being on your website.
That's right. Thor's the show that keeps on giving.
That's right. Yeah. And then, what was it? You've got Space Glider and Keep the Dogs Away Volume 2 on Cleopatra Records. So you got another record deal now, Cleopatra Records. What's the deal with that? Where are they based out of and what are they doing for you?
I've been with them. This is our 10-year anniversary, actually.
Nice.
You know, I've been with them since 2014 and here we are.
They do
an incredible job. They really market the records and I'd say they're the top rock label right now in the world because not everybody's doing rock for one thing.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of pop labels, rap labels. You know, I look at the Grammys, you know, it's rap.
Well, that's a different world now, eh?
That's a different world, right?
Sure,
I still respect rap and I respect pop, but you know, I still, you know, love rock. I listen to everything. Yeah. But they're a great label, great packaging too.
Nice.
Really nice packaging and artwork.
Well, you've got lots, like I said, the website is impressive and there's lots of stuff on there. You got merch, you got the discography, you've got, I went through it all and there's the bios and lots of great stuff on there to check out the past tours. So that's really good. And then you've got the new video out that I just went to. It's a lyrics video, Ride of the Iron Horse, which has just now come out. Is that correct? I've watched that a couple times and that's cool.
Yes. Really proud of the song and some of, like I said, getting some good comments on it. I like the Leonard Cohen comment because I think my voice has gotten a little heavier and lower over the years.
Well,
so
okay.
I think the only way to go is up now. And we have a series of singles coming out and we'll have a high action single coming out.
Yeah.
With a video,
nice.
The next one, right? It's going to be called Shields Up. So it should be good. You know, shows the whole band and Frank Soto will be in it.
Great. Well, that's great to hear that Frank's a friend. And then Kevin Swain is a good friend of mine as well.
Kevin Swain. I want to say that Kevin Stewart Swain did a remarkable job, not only playing on the record, but producing the record. A talent upon talents.
Well, he's just a first-class guy too, right?
Yeah,
he's first a first-class class guy, you know. So
yes.
I think it's great to have people like Kevin and Frank in your corner and working with you. Like I always look for people, especially as I've gotten older, I want to deal with my friends. I always tell people that just treat me like a friend. I'm not a commodity. I'm just a guy. I want to sing. I want to play, but treat me like a friend. And those two guys, you know that they care about you as a person rather than as a commodity. And I think that counts for a lot.
You know, that's it. We're friends, you know, we can go down, go and to Red Lobster in Calgary and have a meal or go to the White Spot in Vancouver and, you know, talk about stuff, old days and, you know.
Yeah, but they care about you as a person. That to me, you know, like it must make you feel awful when someone just treats you like a commodity. And then I've heard that story from lots of people. And my friend Henry said that, you know, that they treat you like they're your best friend. When you're doing something for them, and as soon as the record deal's over or that ends, you're dead to me. They don't even talk to you anymore.
I'm a friend of theirs.
And
they're a friend of mine. You know,
good. Yeah, you're good. Around
just
good
like
people.
We put, you know, putting even the music aside, we just, you know, we could play Pinochle. You know, checkers. You know, we don't even have to talk about music. We're just friends. No, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm happy for you on that. And then you've got dates coming up. I see on there, you've got them right on the front page. Actually, you're going to go to Denver and Salt Lake and you're going to do the Whiskey a Go-Go this year. Is that right?
That's where the 50th anniversary will be.
Oh, yes. That's so great.
Of course, playing with Frank and Kevin Stewart Swain.
Nice. Awesome.
In Calgary and Edmonton, April 12th in Calgary and April 13th in Edmonton.
Yeah, that's on there too. So anybody who's listening to this, make sure you get out and support Thor and the shows that he's doing and stuff. It's just great that you're out there doing your thing and you're recording and you're active. So I'm pretty happy about that. I think it's, I care for you as a person too. That's just the way that I deal with people. So I treat people like my friends and make sure that, you know, you want what's best for a person. Cause I've seen lots of people who are successful, but they're not living their best life. And your friends want you to live your best life. They want what's best for you as a person. And so I'm one of those guys too.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate that.
And you've gone through, I was going to ask you about the member changes. I don't know what it was. Lots of bands in the past have just had lots of different band members. You've seemed to have settled now a little bit with Frank and Kevin, but you've played with, I don't think you could even count the amount of band members and people you've played with over the years.
Yeah, well, the thing is it's very expensive to tour. And there's been times where there just wasn't enough in the budget to take a band on tour.
Right.
And
okay.
So I had to go to places and many times the promoter would have a backup band or like, for example, I'd go to Minnesota and meet band members there and and they would back me or whatever. Right. You know?
Yeah.
And that's just how it had to be, you know?
Yeah. No, fair enough. That's a common refrain. Again, it's not exclusive to you for sure. Like some of the bands have to have a sponsor and then they still, and other bands have gone on tour, as you know, and come back owing money. They're broke when they come back.
It's very expensive. You have to be very careful. You know, you don't want to get into debt going on tour.
For sure. So I always ask my guests, you know, what would you change looking back over the last 50 years? If there was something that you could change or do differently, what would that be?
Nothing. Nope. If I set the reset button, there's a song on the new album called No Time for Games. And it's just as the lyrics are in the song. If I hit the reset button, I wouldn't change a thing. And right. That's how I feel.
Well, and you make a fair point, because a lot of people have said, you know, everything that happened to me, whether I caused it or whether it was caused to me, made me the person I am today. And I'm kind of pretty comfortable in my own skin. So that's the way life goes.
Absolutely.
So you got lots going on too, right? You're got these shows coming up and you're still recording and writing, and you got Kevin and Frank on board. So it sounds like you're in a good place. Are you happy?
Very, very happy. Good. Having a good time, you know?
Yep. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Well, right on. Well, I really appreciate you, taking my rapid fire questions and stuff. And I always wanted to sit down and talk to you after I had initially talked to you 40 something years ago, but I wanted to have you on the show, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come on.
Thank you very much, Dan. It was a pleasure to talk to you again after 40 years. And,
yes, there you go.
Hope we won't be that long till we meet again.
Many thanks to John Michael Thor for being part of the Liner Notes podcast and sharing some insights from his fun-filled life in the music business. More information is available at thorcentral.net. Excellent website. Check it out. There's lots of stuff on there. Hope you enjoyed the podcast and invite you to subscribe to it and share it on social media so others can enjoy it as well. And we also invite you to listen to Dusty Discs Radio Tuesdays and Thursdays to hear music from the artists you're hearing on this show. So until next time, I'm Dan Harris.